You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. It's Econ 101, I think. Increasing demand, lower supply gets you rising prices. Everywhere, apparently, except with California water. Drought economics on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 7th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The California Water Resources Control Board would no doubt like to have a little chat with the 38 or so million residents of the Golden State, especially those in Southern California. The board was out with its latest report today. It showed water use in Los Angeles and San Diego actually increased, yes, increased in the middle of a drought, 2% in February. Northern Californians were more prudent. Their conservation helped the state cut its overall water use, but nowhere near the 25% mandatory cuts that Governor Brown ordered a week or so ago. One way to get there might be to change the economics of water use, raise its price. But that, of course, is harder to do than you might think. Marketplace's David Weinberg starts us off today.
Water is cheap. And in a place like dry California, many would argue that the cost of water is too low, given just how scarce it is. But raising the price of water is a political nightmare anywhere in the country, especially in California, the land of propositions. Kelly Salt is an attorney who works on water issues.
Proposition 218 requires that any fees that you impose can't exceed the proportionate cost of providing your service.
In other words, Californians voted to limit how much utilities can charge for water. So if it costs a utility 1 penny to deliver a gallon, the most it can charge for that is 1 penny. In the past, one tool utilities have used to get around Proposition 218 is to charge tiered rates. Customers who use a lot of water pay higher rates. Tiered rates are now under challenge in a current court case.
It's difficult to know what the court is going to say in that case. That's the big if.
One thing that is for certain, as of July 1st, the price of water in Southern California is going up. The Metropolitan Water District, which brings water into Southern California from outside the region, is charging penalties to utilities that exceed their allotments. And those utilities will have to pass those costs down to customers. The cost of that extra water could be 4 times the current rate. Ken Barenclaw is an associate professor in the School of Public Policy at UC Riverside.
So you're either going to see some pain associated with reducing demand, or you're going to see pain in terms of a higher water bill if you don't reduce demand.
But either way, it's going to be painful.
Either way, yeah, there's going to be a consequence, right? And that's just sort of the nature of it when water becomes so scarce. Something's got to be done.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Just because the Greek debt crisis was getting a little bit humdrum, I mean, how often can things go down to the wire anyway? The newish government in Athens has decided to spice things up. It has revived an issue raised by both left and right-wing governments of the past, and it's put a price tag on the long-standing claims for World War II reparations that it says Germany owes. 278 billion euros, or a little bit over $300 billion, is the suggested balance due. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on that story.
So how did Greece reach this figure? It totaled up the cost of death and destruction, looting of gold and architectural treasures, forced bank loans. If Germany paid up, that would be more than enough to get Greece out of debt. But will it? Jan Randolph is an expert on sovereign risk at IHS.
The German war debt reparations is really a separate issue. I think that it's not part and parcel of the current negotiations to keep Athens afloat.
Moreover, pressing Germany for compensation may not be possible under international law. Reparations were long ago paid by Germany and accepted by Greece and other countries. So why press the issue now? Andrew Hilton is at the Center for the Study of Financial Innovation in London.
It keeps a nice warm glow in the heart of the Greeks back home. But there is a legal case for it. Greece was not compensated properly after the war. It was a very brutal occupation.
But raising the issue has angered major political figures in Germany, and Greece needs Germany's okay to get more bailout money and keep out of default. Jan Randolph says Greece is trying to gain sympathy among other indebted euro countries that might also resent German power.
Countries like Portugal and Ireland that have been through the bailout, they've taken the harsh medicine and they're out now. They don't see any reason why Greece should be a special case.
Besides, fresh negotiations over reparations would take years, and Greece's debt is a more immediate problem. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of that Greek debt and the immediate problem, as Mitchell just was, there is every indication Athens will be able to make a nearly $500 million payment that is due to the IMF day after tomorrow. But after that, all bets are off. Speculation, and we should say it is just that because nobody really knows, speculation is that Greece runs out of cash by the end of the month without another slice of bailout money. On Wall Street today, try though they might have, traders just couldn't hold on. Today we will have the details when we do the numbers. Higher education in this country means, to many minds, one thing: college. And there is a huge push to get more kids into college in this country. At the same time, though, employers say they don't have enough skilled workers, workers who might not need a college degree. Interestingly, you don't hear those same complaints in some other places where apprenticeships can be as common as colleges here. From WGBH, Kirk Carapeza has the latest in our series on higher education in Germany.
Soccer is huge in the small industrial city of Leverkusen.
Leverkusen coming out strong right at the start. Benarabi's made it 1-0!
Emblazoned on the players' jerseys is the word Bayer, as in Bayer aspirin. The giant pharmaceutical company sponsors the team and is so firmly rooted here that Germans have nicknamed Leverkusen Bayer Town. Inside Bayer's sprawling chemical plant, students learn how to make the primary ingredient in aspirin.
What are you learning here?
Basically all chemistry. But there's a focus on running the plant, too.
Roger Hips of Cologne is one of thousands of students Bayer trains each year. The company and the state cover the cost. Students get paid around $1,200 a month, and they're virtually assured a well-paying job at Bayer when they're done with the three-year program.
You're almost finished. Has it been difficult?
It does get more complex as the training progresses, but the teachers are very good.
Roger is in a classic German apprenticeship. It includes on- and off-the-job training while studying at a technical college. The system not only provides a well-trained workforce, but also gives many young Germans their ticket to the middle class.
If you can support yourself on an industrial income, buy a house, drive a big car, I mean, why do you necessarily have to go to university?
Frieder Wolf teaches political science at the University of Heidelberg, Germany's most prestigious institution. He says the 60% of Germans who choose the apprenticeship program over traditional college have become the country's blue-collar aristocracy.
Arbeiter aristokratie. And they are highly skilled, and the education they receive is attuned to the needs of these industries.
Wolf points out there are still people who look down on apprenticeship programs, but for the most part, these future craftsmen, chemical engineers, and nuclear plant workers are very well respected.
For the competitiveness of the German economy in the world, they have much more impact than the political scientists we're training here.
There are enough political scientists. Is that what you're saying, as a political scientist?
There are maybe not enough excellent ones, but well, the problem is now that all ways of education compete for a limited number of young people.
As American employers bemoan the lack of well-trained workers and parents and students question the value of a four-year degree, there are lessons to be learned here. Nancy Hoffman is with the Boston-based think tank Jobs for the Future.
We don't have a tradition of employers thinking long-term about building a pipeline, of, as they call them in Europe, of young professionals. And we have a screen for employees, which is, do you have a four-year college degree?
Hoffman says the U.S. should adopt a system similar to the German model, something that allows young people to be in a mix of work and school.
And they may turn out to be philosophers and sociologists, but they may also turn out to love engineering and IT. And we provide very few opportunities for young people to have that kind of experience.
In fact, just a handful of states, including Massachusetts, Virginia, and California, have introduced on-the-job training in some schools for students aged 15 to 20. Back in Bayertown, Roger Hipp says he's passionate about what he's learning. He knew that he wanted to work in a chemical plant early on.
It started in 7th or 8th grade, and I noticed it was fun to get to know the chemical elements and see the reactions. That was when I decided to work here.
But that decision might just as easily have been made for Hipps by his school, even before he reached 7th grade. Under the German system, millions of students are tracked into trades or college based on test scores and teacher recommendations as early as 9 years old. We'll have more on that controversial tracking system tomorrow. In Leverkusen, Germany, I'm Kirk Carapeza for Marketplace.
You can find Kirk's entire series on the many, many ways the Germans do higher ed on our website. It is, repeat after me, marketplace.org. Coming up.
He went into his office, got a pad of paper and a 2H pencil, and said, put the pencil to the paper, and it has more value than it did as separate parts.
Producer Brian Grazer on how he made it in Hollywood. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. The Dow Industrial's off 5 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 17,875. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ off 7 points, about a 10%. Ended things at 49.10. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.2%, 2,076. Delivery service FedEx bumped up 0.7% today. It's agreed to take over TNT Express, one of Europe's largest delivery companies, for about $5 billion. TNT danced up 28% on the news. Berkshire Hathaway shed a 3%. Warren Buffett's company plans to take a 10% stake in Axalta Coating Systems. It makes specialized coatings for cars and trucks. Axalta buffed up almost 10% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 1.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to depart for a trip to Jamaica and then Panama, where he'll attend the Summit of the Americas later this week. Alcoa, Bed Bath & Beyond, and WD-40 release quarterly earnings. And 25 years ago, the TV series Twin Peaks premiered. Will there be another outing for Agent Cooper? It's a mystery. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Microsoft is working on a new hiring program. The company is going to start recruiting more people with autism. On the face of it, the right thing to do. On the business side of it, though, a smart thing to do. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
27-year-old Aaron Michael Cohen says he was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when he was a child. He says it's given him very specific skills.
Well, I'm good at math, and I'm also good at noticing patterns.
Cohen has put those skills to work. He's a data analyst in the IT department at Freddie Mac. He looks for irregular patterns that signal a problem with company computers. These are the types of skills that make Cohen very popular in the tech world. So it's no wonder Microsoft is reaching out to the autistic community.
This is a smart move on Microsoft's part.
Ramon Lamas is a tech analyst at IDC. He says Microsoft is getting a twofer. It gets some nice PR and essential workers. People with autism fall across a wide spectrum. Some have unique skills, like Cohen, including attention to detail, which is essential for coding.
You know, even if a code is off by one space bar or one period, you know, that could throw the entire code and it can throw the entire program off.
Microsoft might have to make some adjustments. Workers with autism may not like the open plan office where everybody can hear everybody else. But if they're happy, they're loyal, says Samantha Crane of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network.
They're far more likely to stay as long as they're getting the right kind of understanding and are in the right kind of culture.
Microsoft isn't giving interviews yet because the hiring program is still in the pilot stage. But in a blog, the company says the disabled workers it's already hired have a quit rate of only 1%. Microsoft plans to start the pilot program in May with about 10 candidates. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Ports out on the West Coast are, by and large, back to work after the long labor dispute earlier this year. But back to work, however, does not mean back to normal, at least at the Port of Portland, Oregon in particular. The port has lost almost all of its container shipping businesses, including, as of this week, both its biggest and second biggest carriers. Those would be Hanjin out of South Korea and the German firm Hapag-Lloyd. That has left companies all over the Pacific Northwest scrambling to find ways to get their goods to markets overseas. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson has that story.
It's a weekday morning, and a tangle of trucks idles outside a container yard in Portland, Oregon. The situation's a mess. Inside a barbed-wired fence, large metal shipping containers are stacked three, even five high. Outside, trucks from around the state are jockeying to get in. Those that can't are blocking the road.
Here's not normal. This is very unnormal.
Ron Lobdale is one of the many truck drivers waiting in line to drop off a container and pick up another load.
Just been backed up like this pretty good.
Normally, Lobdale would be taking his containers to the Port of Portland for their journey to Asian markets, like Japan. But that's not happening so much anymore. That's because just weeks ago, South Korean-based carrier Hanjin Shipping officially left Portland. The carrier complained it was taking too long to load and unload its ships because of a nearly three-year-long local labor dispute between union members and their employer. Hanjin accounted for about 80% of all the business at Oregon's only international container port. Now, most of the goods that were heading through the Port of Portland need to travel more than 170 miles north to the ports of Seattle and Tacoma. But that's proving to be a challenge.
Well, right now, just the chaos that's going on and nobody really knowing how they're going to get their freight moved from point to point.
David Brayman is the general manager of Mitchell Brothers Truck Line. With Hanjin gone, businesses here have two options. They can move their containers by rail or truck. But Brayman says recently trains have been so packed they've been leaving containers behind. And he says the sudden change in shipping options means there's also a shortage of trucks.
We're getting inundated with phone call after phone call for people looking for rates.
He's referring to shipping rates, as in how much it's going to cost a company to truck its containers to and from Seattle, Tacoma. Trips to Puget Sound shipping terminals can be four times as costly and take three times as long as a trip to the Port of Portland.
Something's going to get left behind, and we're all in that same predicament. There's nobody here that's up to this speed yet.
This right here, yes, it's going to go to Japan. I can just tell by the loading style and the fact
Jelly Boschert Davis is the vice president of international sales for Bosco Trading in Salem, Oregon. She's pointing to a forklift as it whizzes by and into a container, backed up against the biggest barn you've ever seen. We're deep in the Willamette Valley, the grass seed capital of the world. For years, Davis has relied on Hanjin to ship grass straw from the Port of Portland.
We are just one of probably 13, 14 exporters that bale up the straw, the grass straw that's left behind in the field. And we bale it, press it, containerize it, and ship it to Japan and Korea for cattle feed.
Agriculture is a $5 billion industry in Oregon, and about 40% of what's grown in the state is sold outside of the country. Davis says it takes her trucks a day and a half to do what they once did in a day. That means her whole system of moving straw through the ports has been disrupted.
And so it just logistically is much more of a nightmare for us.
With Hanjin and now Hapag-Lloyd both gone, the economic fallout may not be limited to companies already shipping goods. Many in the business community worry it will also be harder to attract new companies to this part of the Pacific Northwest. In Portland, I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
I'm just going to go ahead and guess that to the extent you know the name Brian Grazer, it's for the movies he's made. Films like Apollo 13 and A Beautiful Mind, or maybe from the hit television shows like Arrested Development or more recently Empire. He is also, as of today, an author. His new book isn't so much of a how-to guide as it is a how-to-ask-the-right-questions guide. It's a thing that Grazer's been doing for more than 30 years, back way back before he was somebody, talking his way into conversations with people at the tops of their fields just to pick their brains. The book is called A Curious Mind. Brian Grazer, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Take me back to Santa Monica, California, 1973 or so, and how you got your first job in show business.
Overhearing a conversation about how there's this very easy job, and I was in an apartment complex, and I overheard these two guys saying it's the cushiest, easiest job in Los Angeles. So I closed the drapes, but yet opened the window so I could clearly hear them talk. And it was at Warner Brothers legal department, and I immediately got the phone number, which was 843-6000, called, asked for Peter Connect, and I was hired within an hour.
And you're off and running on this career, and we will talk about the curious mind, but I wonder if another way to frame what got you started on this whole thing was you just being nosy and listening to these guys' conversation.
Well, being nosy is an aspect of curiosity, so I was probably yet under that umbrella of curiosity, certainly.
This book is basically the story of you calling a bunch of really famous people when you were a nobody and bugging them until you got in their front door.
I started when I was about 25. I would just generate lists, list after list after list, and pick subjects and then people within subjects that I wanted to meet. And I, every 2 weeks, almost as a religion or like a religion, would go meet somebody that was expert in any of those areas just to ask questions and dig inside what could be the truth of what they're doing. And no, it was a lot of begging, a lot of groveling, a lot of calling assistance of assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And often, you know, meeting that assistant to the assistant in a parking lot at Universal Studios or wherever they're going to be, and trying to persuade them over time to let me meet their boss. I'd say, I don't want any job. I don't want anything. I just want to be able to meet with them for a few minutes. And that few minutes usually could turn into an hour, hour and a half.
Early on, you get in to see Lou Wasserman, who was back then, you say, the most powerful man in Hollywood. He was the head of MCA. He had been around forever. And he basically gives you 10 minutes and says, hey, kid, get out of my sight, in essence.
He stopped me before I could actually get in the office and said, you know, what are you here for? I mean, he could see right through me that I had very little to add to his life. And he wasn't wrong. But he did say, just sit tight. And he went into his office, got a pad of paper and a 2H pencil and said, put the pencil to the paper and it has more value than it did as separate parts. Hmm. Now get out of here. Hmm. And I first felt kind of, insulted and kind of my ego was pretty undermined. But then I thought he was right. And I thought about what he meant. And he meant was create stories that you could own. And I started manufacturing stories. And within, you know, in a short time, I actually created and wrote the story and movie to Splash.
You met Ron Howard, your producing partner many years, your best friend, you call him, basically by a cold call, right?
Definitely. I looked out my window and I saw Ron Howard, who was the actor on Happy Days. And before that, of course, Andy and Mayberry. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to meet this guy. And then I cold called his office and said, I was the guy that was yelling out the window, hey, let's meet. And he agreed. He came into my office and he said, I want to be a movie director. And I said, well, I want to be a movie producer. And we were both two guys that weren't doing the things that we wanted to be. And I said, here, I have these two projects. One is called Night Shift. It's a comedy about two guys that create a call girl ring in the New York City morgue. And the other one is about a mermaid. He said, I don't want to do the mermaid either, but I'll do the other one. So we found a way to get that movie made.
Once a project of yours is birthed, once Apollo 13 was on the road to getting made, or once Empire Now is in production and doing really well, what do you do? Do you just sit there and watch it happen?
Well, you want to try to maintain its success. Because, well, let's say Apollo 13. When Apollo 13, first of all, it surprised Tom Hanks, Ron Howard, and myself, because everybody knew they made it back safely.
Yeah,
I mean, it was already a point of history. They knew. It was about making sure that the very expensive dollars that are used to market the movie are about keeping people, I mean, I said curious again, but it's really true.
Yeah.
You have to be at a very heightened state of curiosity. Why will they pick it over Game of Thrones? Why will they pick it over Breaking Bad? You have to create those reasons. So I definitely don't just sit back and watch it happen. I wish I could just sit back and watch it happen.
You know him from movies and television, also now books, Brian Grazer. It's called A Curious Mind. Brian, thanks very much.
Wow, thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, American politics and capitalism all rolled up into one. Rand Paul officially declared his candidacy for president this afternoon, as you might have heard. To that end, he needs to raise money, to which end there is now an online store at his campaign website where memorabilia and trinkets abound. Paul is not the only politician to do this, but there are some items you might be interested in. You can get a pair of Rand Paul socks for $15, Stand with Rand car mats, floor mats for $70. And because I don't think his campaign staff really thought this one through, Stand with Rand flip-flops. Get it? Politicians flip-flops for the low price of just $20. Also, this, just because that day is almost upon us. If you are young, ambitious, like working with numbers, and are looking for a job, the Internal Revenue Service wants you. I saw this on Bloomberg the other day. More than half the people in the IRS are over 50 years old. Only 650 of the 37,000 people who collect, process, enforce, and refund our taxes are under the age of 25. You got a week left, everybody. All righty, we are out of here. The Dow off 5 points today. That's less than a 10%. The NASDAQ off 7 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500, 4 points lower, 0.2%. Caitlin Ash, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishad Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.